I'm Nick Harcourt, and welcome to another episode of The Sound of Success, the podcast where we talk with movers, shakers, and just plain cool people about music. On this episode of The Sound of Success, I'm speaking with Kate Pearson, songwriter, singer, lyricist, and founding member of the B-52s, who formed in Athens, Georgia in 1976. Kate plays guitar, bass, and keyboards, and the B-52s have a long list of hits, including Rock Lobster, Planet Claire, Party Out of Bounds, Private Idaho, Summer of Love, Love Shack, Rome, and Funplex. The list goes on. Kate has a distinctive mezzo-soprano vocal range, which is a trademark of the band's unique sound. And outside of her work with the B-52s, she's also collaborated through the years with many other artists, including the Ramones, Iggy Pop, David Byrne, R.E.M. And at the time of our conversation, Kate is readying her second solo album, Radio and Rainbows. Kate, it's so good to catch up with you.
Hey, Nick. It's good to see you again. We have some history. We've known each other for a long time.
I was a big fan of your band from the late 70s onwards when I lived in the UK and then Australia. And when I moved to the US in 1988, where I got into radio in Woodstock, New York, and you were living there. And I'll be honest, I was quite starstruck when I would see you driving through town. And then we met through some mutual friends. And you were in Woodstock or thereabouts for quite some time.
Well, I still live in Woodstock, too. This is my wife, Monica, and I sold Lazy Meadow. It was a roadside hotel that we just brought to its former glory. And it had quite a bit of success in Mount Tremper near Woodstock. And Monica ran that really for 20 years or so. And we sold it recently during the pandemic. We sold it and we bought a place here in Cape Cod for a second home. And it's opened up whole new vistas to me to be by the ocean. It's just, I never realized what I was missing. And now I'm not missing it.
Yeah, you're right there. And you had another place in the desert as well, didn't you? You had some airstreams in the desert. And I know you were selling that as well.
Yeah, so it was Kate's Lazy Meadow and Kate's Lazy Desert near Joshua Tree in Landers. And we just sold that too. Because Monica's really, really doesn't want to do that kind of hospitality business anymore. And I was involved in it a lot, and it just seemed like, every time I went and looked, although I recently stayed in one of the trailers at Lazy Desert where there were airstreams, and all I could think about is this needs fixing, that needs fixing. So I'm really happy that someone else has taken over and making it better.
Time to get out of the hospitality business. Everything changes, right?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know until I did my research for this interview that you were actually born in New Jersey.
Yes.
You grew up in the Northeast, went to college in Chicago and Boston, and you studied journalism. What were your dreams and aspirations as a kid and as a teenager?
I mean, I've always wanted to do music from the first time I, opened my mouth and used to sing in the car. I used to stick my head out the window and make up songs and thought no one, my parents couldn't hear me. They were in there smoking. But I thought, I always wanted to be a musician, but, as always, your parents say, I did want to go to college, but I really kind of lost that thread when I went to college. I mean, I often thought, why didn't I run away to the village, and my aspiration was to be kind of a folk singer, because I was very influenced by Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan and Buffy St. Marie and Joni Mitchell and all, especially the sort of topical folk singers, Phil Oakes. And that politicized me at an early age when I was in, I had a folk protest band with some friends in high school, junior high, called the Sun Donuts. And we wrote our own songs. And I was very interested in, the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam movement. And later on, I was able, when I went to college, to protest and become involved. But I think that's really what turned me on to journalism and politics. So I thought, well, if I'm not a musician, I can be an investigative journalist.
I know when you finished school, you went to Europe for a while, traveled around, worked in London for a while.
Well, I actually worked in Newcastle.
Oh, you worked in Newcastle?
Yes. I mean, that is a switch. It's kind of like if someone from England came to the United States and decided to work in Detroit in a bar.
Newcastle's quite a place. Describe it for those who haven't been there.
Well, Newcastle's a very, I guess people in the South, there's a big divide between South and North of England and people, yeah, more working class, very direct and forthright. in Newcastle. I love the people there. And the accent was so hard. I didn't understand anyone. And when I left after, I was probably there for 8 months, I was saying, way I, they have a very distinct accent. But, and I worked as a bartendress. That's what they called it. And the Anson Hotel and Pub. And it had three different bar situations. They had the men's vault, which was only men, obviously. Wow. And then they had a bar sitter, which was for the ladies and the gentlemen. And then they had like a bar where the kids would come or young people would come. And that was like there were fights in there all the time. It was just crazy, but it was really interesting. And I'm glad I went there. Really, I was so over the United States at 1970 after Kent State. I thought, here we are protesting, trying to make the country better, and we're getting shocked. You know, students are getting shot. So that's when I decided, okay, I'm getting out of here. I'll see what it's like, you know, expand my horizons and go to Europe. And hitchhiked. I went with a friend and we went all over the place. And it was just an amazing kind of adventure. And I'll never be as free again, I guess, as we were then.
I was talking to my daughter last night, and I was talking about this conversation I was going to have today, and that you'd spent some time in the UK and Europe after school. And we decided together that if we were running the place, when kids leave school, they should go somewhere in the world for 6 months before they do anything else.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree.
You moved back to the US. What took you to Athens?
I mean, it's a very long story, but to make a long story longer, you know, I had a friend who I went to Europe with, my friend Jan, and she went back and I wound up staying for a year and a half. And I met this Englishman from Manchester and we fell in love, and he was working on fishing boats in Newcastle when I was a bartendress. And so he wanted to go. My visa ran out and went to America. We thought we'd go to South Carolina. But instead, my friend said, come visit me. She was living on the south of Boston coast. She said, oh, come visit. And the people she lived in the house with happened to be driving to Athens. And one of them said, oh, my brother can give Brian a job without a green card. And we got this little house, a tenant farmer's shack, $15 a month in the middle of a field, just a funky old shack. It really was a love shack. And it had a tin roof.
Must have been fun when it rained.
That's how I ended up in Athens. These people, so I skipped a chapter there. The people in Jan's house were driving to Athens to hike the Appalachian Trail. As I said, her friend, one of the guys there said he could get Brian a job in Athens. So we just went along with them.
Oh.
So we went along for the ride and wound up in Athens. And that's how it all began. And we just did it back to the land thing and had a huge garden and just really got to know our neighbors, but we didn't even venture. We didn't have a car. We rode our bikes into town sometimes and went to parties. And then eventually I met the band members. And then, you know, we started hanging out. And then we jammed one night. The rest is history.
So legend says the B-52s came together after you all met and shared a flaming volcano drink.
Yes.
At a Chinese restaurant in Athens. First of all, I don't know what's in a flaming volcano, but I'm presuming it's a drink that's on fire.
It's on fire. We had 5 or 6 straws, actually, because we had a friend with us, Owen. And after we had that flaming volcano, it's like a rum punch, you know, it's like a tiki drink. And it was Hunan's Chinese restaurant, and it was they had those exotic drinks. We couldn't afford food, so we got the flaming volcano. And then we decided to go to Owen's house and we started jamming. He went upstairs and wrote a paper. He became a psychologist, you know. So the rest of us formed the band that night. We started jamming. We wrote a song called Killer Bees. And it's never really fully formed. We never recorded it formally, but there was a recording of it. So we just felt like, wow, this is fun. There's nothing really much to do here in Athens. There's no scene. There's no really clubs or bars, nothing really happening. So we started writing songs and we started getting, you know, pretty good. We did it for ourselves, for our own amusement. We didn't really have a whole lot of aspirations. And I'd say Ricky Wilson in our band had the most kind of motivation and vision, because he said he had a 5-year plan. I don't know if he ever told us what that 5-year plan was. But we started going to New York City and playing there and CBGBs and Max's Kansas City. And then pretty soon we caught the attention of Talking Heads, Blondie, and all these different bands. And then we got interest from record companies, and we got the manager that managed Talking Heads. And he signed us to Warner Brothers and Island Records.
So I read a quote from you where you described the band like this: we each brought our own kind of craziness to it. There's just something about all of us coming together that created this genie in a bottle blend. It's like lightning in a bottle, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is a bottle-headed monster, really, because we all have similar backgrounds. And we're all kind of from barely, you know, lower middle class families. And we all have this wacky sense of humor. And we all kind of were influenced by B movies and surf guitar. And I mean, we just love music in Athens. An eclectic kind of music. We all had very eclectic taste. And, you know, we listened to African music and Nina Roto. And, you know, we just listened to all different kinds of music, Latin music. And so we, and surf guitar, and we would dance all the time. One thing about Athens, I said there was no scene there, but there was a party scene, a very big party scene. And the whole thing was crash a party, free booze, and dancing. We would dance anytime, any place.
You mentioned once you started getting a little bit of attention, spending time in New York and being a part, very much a part of the punk and new wave scene. What was that like? And two-part question. First of all, as a participating artist, and secondly, as an observer.
When you're in it, you don't realize how important it was and what a great scene it was, because everyone was so cooperative, and people would say, oh, go check out this band. There wasn't a rivalry or competitiveness. It seemed like everyone wanted to hear other bands. And I just, whenever we went up there, because we'd go there and play and go right back to Georgia. Sometimes we later start hanging out and doing press, and we stayed, you know, on people's floors, and we stayed at some pretty cheap hotels. But it was just it was a beautiful scene, really. I think the punk scene was a little more rough. And when we came around just a little bit, enough to be part of that punk scene, you know, hearing Talking Heads and Blondie and Suicide and Patti Smith, and just being in that, we were kind of, well, it was a record company name. They made up New Wave, whatever that means. But, you know, we were really part of the punk scene.
Is it true that you're all living together in a shared house at this time?
Well, not yet. We were still living in Athens. So we did do our first jam in 1976, but our first gig was Valentine's Day, 1977, at a party in Athens. So later that year, we started going up to New York, and we'd play, and we kind of go right back because we didn't have enough money to stay too long. But I got to just see so many great bands, and everyone was so welcoming. And we went over to Blondie's house, and they had all these gold records, you know, lining the floor. They didn't hang them up. And we were taken under the wing, really, of Tina and Chris from Talking Heads, who introduced us to their manager and who got us signed. But we were having a lot of record company interest. They were coming to Athens, Seymour Stein, who I think is a great, has great taste in music. He was very interested in signing us, but we were the band that got away, I guess. But Virgin Records, all these people started, you know, record companies had interest in us. And eventually Gary Kerfer signed us to Warner Brothers and also Island Records, Chris Blackwell. So, but the scene was just, everyone was kind of in it together, and everyone hung out a lot and listened to music, listened to each other's music. So I felt like it was a, you know, love fest kind of scene. So after we got signed in 1979, we just took off, flew to the Bahamas to record with Chris Blackwell. So we had to get a place. Our manager said, you've got to live in New York. And we're like, why? Oh, no, you got to be near the airport. And we thought, well, all right, it's an adventure. Let's move to New York. So we looked around, and for some reason, we all said, why didn't we go to Woodstock at least? But we wound up in this weird place called Lake Mahopac. And we got this big house. It was a beautiful house on a lake, but it was kind of in the middle of nowhere in a way. It was like a sort of well, nobody liked us in the town. There was one ice cream place and people jeered at us actually when we were walking down to the downtown.
The weirdos who live in that house.
Exactly. And so, you know, people would yell, hippie. It was like The Shining. I mean, living in this house together, it was kind of too much. I wouldn't recommend it. But we got along and we wrote some stuff. We were writing songs and but eventually Fred was the first to bail. Like he said, this is a crazy house, you know, and I'm just getting out. So we moved to New York City and then eventually we all kind of bailed out, sold the house. But, you know, when we were in Athens, we each had our own place and we had our own lives and we had, you know, I had goats. I raised goats and had this big garden and had chickens and everything. And I had to leave all that. And, you know, sometimes I wish like REM, we had stayed in Athens, but it was also good to kind of then start living in New York City. Cause that was a whole other adventure.
You mentioned going to the Bahamas to record the first album, the self-titled debut album. And I think you did your second album there as well, Wild Planet. And you're starting to build a bigger audience with songs like Private Idaho, Party Out of Bounds. You mentioned David Byrne and Talking Heads. I know you worked with David as well. And you were having success. There's no doubt about it. This is a band that was definitely well known. I knew about you in England.
Yeah, we were successful in England, I think, too.
Yeah, very much so. And in 1985, you lost Ricky, who passed away from HIV/AIDS. How did you guys deal with that and then reconfigure to keep going?
It was devastating. I mean, we really were knocked down on our heels and we took maybe a year to just grieve. And at some point, right after Ricky died, Keith Strickland, who was the drummer in our band and, you know, co-creator, because we wrote collectively. That's an unusual thing because we did write together by jamming and then piecing the parts together. So he wanted to get out of town. And our friend Laura Levine, I think you know Laura Levine, photographer.
Yeah.
She invited us to stay with her in Woodstock. So we came up, Keith and I came up, and he decided he'd look for a house. And then I went to find a little cabin. And so I lived across the pond from Keith. And so I'd row my canoe over there. And after a year or so, Keith said, you know, I've been writing some music and thinking about, you know, should we get back together? And I liked the music. He played it for the others. And we really felt like this would be, I mean, we actually said out loud, this is not for hit. It's not for radio. It's for us to heal. It's for Ricky. And, you know, it was really about getting healing and it sort of conjured the spirit of Ricky in a lot of ways. And a lot of the songs were reminiscent of our early time in Athens, a time of, you know, kind of innocence. And we weren't thinking about ambition. Well, we never really thought much about ambition. But, I mean, it really wasn't a magical coming together because we started writing together again and the songs just kind of flowed out. And we spent a lot of time talking and just kind of discussing things and just hanging out and then writing. So when it came together, it just seemed like, wow, we had this really story almost. And when Keith sequenced the record, it did have a sort of arc, you know, coming from Deadbeat Club, which is all based on true happenings in Athens and Dry County, and then kind of, you know, coming to Rome and Love Shack, which was the big breakout hit, Rome and Love Shack, but especially Love Shack and Rock Lobster in our early days was kind of the big hit we had in a way because it still drives people crazy when we play it.
And I know Rock Lobster started off as a self-recorded thing that you pressed up 2000 and then re-recorded it later on for the album. But I mean, you started off with a hit, so to speak. But Love Shack is a whole different thing because Cosmic Thing came out actually the year I got into radio, which was 1989, I think. And you mentioned Love Shack. And of course, the video, for those who haven't seen it, do yourself a favor, depending on your age, you may not have seen it. And the B-52s hit the mainstream. How did you guys handle that? And with a record that originally you hadn't thought about in any commercial way, it was just healing as a group of friends. How did you guys deal with all of a sudden big mainstream success?
Well, it was gratifying to hear our songs on the radio, I have to tell you, because thank God for independent radio, because in college radio, because I didn't even really want to play Love Shack at first, and then college radio really got behind it. I mean, it is a bit of a weird song in its structure. Our song structures are always a little not in the usual structure. But college radio really started to play it. And so we started touring, and we toured, and we toured, and we toured, and we started back, sort of back to the basics and some clubs. And then, wow, the record started getting airplay. And then we started playing a little bigger venues. Then we went around again, and we wound up touring for like a year, over a year and a half. But it was very exhausting, but also super gratifying to, I guess, get validation. And most importantly, having people hear the songs, because that's kind of important, I think. Even if you're not after success, it's just you want people to hear your music.
Pretty much every songwriter I've spoken to in any depth about songwriting says that the main thing is to be heard. Just want to be heard.
Yeah. And so many musicians, you know, foolish as we may be business-wise, have varying degrees of monetary success. But the main goal, you're right, most musicians say, I just want the music to be heard.
So the band obviously hit big with that album and continued through the next few years touring. And it's really hard to capture something that big again, isn't it? Did you ever feel any pressure to deliver another Cosmic Thing or another Love Shack?
Well, yeah. I mean, we did Good Stuff, which I think was a really good record, but Cindy left the band. She wanted to start a family. She wanted to leave on a high note. Plus, we were exhausted after the touring of Cosmic Thing. And then also Keith, you know, during Cosmic Thing, had switched to being the guitar player after Ricky died. So there was a whole shift, and we got a larger band, got a bass player, and Sterling Campbell is a drummer. And we had a couple of different drummers, but Zach Alford and Sterling and Tracy Wormworth and Sarah Lee both were bass players on that tour. Keith switched to guitar.
There was a big change. And then Cindy leaving, and Julie Cruz joined the band for a while, right?
Yeah, Julie Cruz joined the band. We wrote Good Stuff, and then Julie Cruz joined for the touring, which was really fun. We missed Cindy, though, and Cindy was very missed. You know, on Good Stuff, but I think it was a really good record. I really think a lot of the songs on Good Stuff were really fun and really good. And then we also worked with Nile Rodgers on that. Then we did Funflex much, much later after many years of touring. We decided, well, let's try, you know, let's just do something for the fans, because at this point, I don't know if we'll have any kind of hit or airplay, but let's just do this for the fans. So we wrote Funflex, which I also am very proud of. I think we did a great job on that. And we do some of those songs in our set sometimes.
That was the last time I really spent any time with you, because the band came on my old KCRW show in 2008 when Funplex was released, which was a ton of fun for me. And I know that you've kept touring on and off through the years. And recently you've been doing some residencies in Vegas. What's it like to sit still in one town and one venue for a week at a time?
Fantastic. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Vegas. I would never go there for a vacation, but it's really kind of fun when you're there for a length of time and you're working, because it's a whole different thing when you're, you know, and we stayed in the Venetian Hotel, and that's where our residency is. And it's the really nice theater. They tried to make it like a Venetian opera house, you know, Vegas style, but it's very comfortable. And I think this setup is very nice. Nice not having to travel, and you can do the show and think, oh, I don't have to fly or drive. I mean, the touring really can wear you down. I mean, airplanes, trains and buses and cars and vans and all kinds of things involved when you're touring and trying to get from A to B. So to be in B is pretty nice. Yeah, it's pretty luxurious. It's something we wanted to do for years, but our current manager, Wayne Sharp, Crush Management, got us this, you know, he followed through.
So I mentioned in our intro that you're about to drop your second solo album. We're recording this in early August of 2024. The album comes out in September of this year. Radio and Rainbows. It's 9 years since your first solo album, Guitars and Microphones. Now, that featured material co-written by Sia. Nick Valenti of The Strokes also played on that album. And I read an interview with you at the time where you said that for a time you felt like it would have been a betrayal if you'd done something on your own outside of the B-52s, that it was a prison created by your own mind. Well, I'm presuming you shook that feeling with the first record. How did you set about writing and recording the songs that became Radio and Rainbows?
Well, some of these songs, and actually when I said a prison of my own mind, sounds a little bit harsh because it was hardly being in prison, being in the B-52s. It's always been the mothership and we still love each other and have fun together and we were successful. So that was a wonderful thing. But I just felt somehow, I guess it was like writer's block. I just felt like when the band was active, and plus there was not a lot of time. We did a lot of touring, just kind of continuous touring and writing. But the real breakthrough came when I was invited to Japan from one of the members of the Plastics, which was kind of like the B-52's counterpart, the punk counterpart to the Japanese sort of new wave counterpart to the B-52s. They were very colorful and fun. And one of them, Sakamasan, became a huge producer in Japan. So he invited me to do this project of songs. He had written the instrumentation. And he invited another singer, Yuki, from a huge, very popular band in Japan. And we collaborated and did this project called Nina. And it became number one in Japan. And we wrote all the songs, Sakamasan, and I collaborated with Yuki. We didn't speak each other's language, but somehow the collaboration was very easy. And we toured Japan. And then I realized I can collaborate with anyone, really. If I could collaborate with someone who doesn't speak my language or I don't speak her language, it was just magical. And something unlocked in my brain. And I thought, okay, now I can write and I can write songs of my own. My wife, Monica, actually became friends with Sia. And we were introduced to her by the band Betty and we became friends. And Monica said, you know, maybe you can work with Sia and this will kind of jumpstart your next project. And so C and I went on writing sessions with different people, Chris Braid and Sam Dixon, and just all, I drove to all different parts of LA. And then she started just really blowing up. And so I started doing some sessions on my own. And it worked every time. Every time I worked with Blue McCauley, and it was just fun to just collaborate with different people. It's just different kind of cross-pollination. They had, you know, all different. It's usually they had the instrumentation and I would do the lyrics and melodies and harmonies and stuff like that. In some cases, there were a little more collaboration. But yeah, it turned out Guitars and Microphones was really a fun project. I did some touring, did some live shows. And then when I started writing, some of these songs that are on Radios and Rainbows are from those early sessions. There are a couple of songs that I wrote back then, and then some I wrote during the pandemic, and I collaborated again with Chris Braid. But there was a gap there because, first of all, we were with a management company that was really kind of against my putting out a solo record, and they kind of kiboshed it in a way. And then when I finally had it all ready, then the pandemic started, and then we did our farewell tour, the B-52's farewell tour. Then there was the pandemic, and I didn't want to put it out then. So it just seemed to be the timeline just stretched out like time can do, and it just became 9 years. It's like, what? This has been ready for a long time. But anyway, finally, I'm putting it out, and I'm in my little rehearsal place now. I'm going to do some live shows, starting with the Cape Cod Arts and Music Festival, Jazz and Music Festival, or it's Jazz and Arts Festival. Anyway, it's here on the Cape, and Tracy Wormworth is joining me, from a bass player from the B-52s, and we're good friends, and also Ken Murray, who plays keyboard with B-52s, keyboard and guitar. So I'm going to take it to, strip it down, basically. It's not going to be a big band with drums, no drums or anything. I just want to have it feature my voice and just the songs. So this is kind of the first time I've done anything like that.
Do you feel a little nervous or just excited?
Nervous and excited. Yeah. Once I do a couple of shows, I'll feel better. But I really want to participate in doing live and being able to do benefits and being able to do some cruises and do just get, you know, not, I don't want to go on the road on a big tour, but I want to be able to just get, you know, do some live shows. And it's been so much fun singing the songs live, just practicing. And we did a little preliminary rehearsals and they're coming back here a couple of days. That's exciting. I just find the songs come alive when you do them, you know, for an audience.
Let's jump to our music questions, the same questions for all of our guests. And we start very early with the question, what is your first musical memory?
Well, my dad played guitar. So my first musical memory was him playing guitar. But the first song that grabbed me was I heard Jerry Lee Lewis singing Great Balls of Fire. And we had one of those old radios. Like an old stand-up radio.
With like a huge piece of furniture.
And it has like this green eye in the middle, like kind of this like light that was this green light. Stare at that. And I remember just having a fit. I just rolled on the floor laughing. It just grabbed me. And then, of course, along came the Beatles and all the other stuff. But that was the first song that really just grabbed me in a visceral way that I just started laughing in this joyful kind of rolling on the floor. It just got me.
Do you remember the first music that you bought with your own money?
It's kind of embarrassing, but I think it might've been Purple People Eater. Yeah, I think that might've been it. And of course, I bought an early Elvis Hound Dog.
What was the first concert you went to without any adult supervision?
Oh, without adult supervision. I mean, the first concert, well, I went with my dad. Palisades Park, New Jersey had like a weekly folk thing, and I was able to see Ramblin' Jack Elliott and Buffy St. Marie and Sonny McGee and Brownie Terry. I mean, these great people. But the first concert I went to on my own was The Doors. When I was in college, they were in Chicago. And it was amazing. A friend of mine brought me, and it was one of those, it was right after the one where Jim Morrison had, you know, pulled his pants down. Mm-hmm. And so he did the same thing. He was like, do you want me to pull my pants down? He was like teasing the audience, and there was kind of a little riot, and it was pretty crazy.
And you're like, I want to be in on this.
Yeah. And then I wanted to be a folk singer, but no, then I got heavily, you know, I got into the whole rock music. I mean, I loved Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell and all, but I love Bob Dylan's electric, you know, adventure. But when I started hearing those California sort of psychedelic groups, oh yeah.
What do you listen to when you want to dance?
I listen to more soul music, I think, and I love African music. And I think every white woman in New York City has taken African dance class, including Black women. But I know all these women that always wanted to take African dance. And there was the teacher there, Joniba, and they had a drummer. And but I love African music. And I listened to one of my favorite shows is this Afropop. Do you know this show, Afropop Worldwide?
Yeah.
And so I always listen to that on NPR. I mean, I dance to anything, really. I love to dance around the house. My wife, Monica, and I frequently dance around the house just whenever something comes on. But, you know, something with a funky beat, soul music a lot, African music, Latin music. I don't have any, you know, particular thing I put on just to dance. When something comes on that makes me want to dance, I'll dance.
What do you listen to when you're feeling sad?
Oh, I listen to Joni Mitchell's Blue, Nina Simone. Not that she's sad, but it's something that her voice is so evocative that it's just sort of sweetly sad. Maybe some classical music, you know, a little Stravinsky.
If you could only hear one song for the rest of your life, what would you choose?
Maybe just be a drum beat. If I had to hear it over and over and over, one song. And would it be continuously playing in my head the rest of my life?
Well, I don't know if it would be, but it's you're on a desert island. Unfortunately, you didn't arrive with CDs or Spotify, but you're allowed one song.
It might be Aretha Franklin's Respect.
All right.
Because that's something uplifting. And I could, you know, if I'm on a desert island, I want to dance, then, you know, that could get me going. Or James Brown, Hot Pants.
Now, the B-52s made some fantastic videos, and the 80s through the 90s were ripe for creativity in that medium. Do you have a favorite music video? And if so, why?
I love Deadbeat Club. I think all of us love that video. So Jeff Price was the director, and we were going for a Fellini vibe. In fact, we had asked Fellini, we sent a letter through our management to the great director, Federico Fellini, who the music, Nino Rota, who did the soundtracks to his movies, was also very influential to us. So we sent a letter, and he actually sent a letter back, whether it was him personally or, but you know, declining, but was very flattered that we asked him, and it was a very nice letter. So then we met Jeff Price, who's a director, and we did it in Athens, and we did it at Armstead Welford's house, and it was this house in Athens that didn't really have electricity, so they hooked up electric to his house, kind of fixed his driveway and did a few things. And so the whole thing sort of took place there. And it became this real, I mean, the song itself just poured out of us. I remember when we wrote it. It's very autobiographical. When Cindy says, I was good, I could talk for hours, you know, and I join in. We were really humming, skinny dipping, going to, you know, get a 25-cent beer. All that is true. Dancing, you know, in the rain, the torn sheets, all that we did in Athens. So the song just sort of came out in this one jam session, like most all of the lyrics and every melody. We really captured that in the video, I think, that really captured that Athens. Michael Stipe is in it. All our friends are in it. So it was just like this kind of bohemian party that we recreated. But in essence, it was a party when we were doing it. It's kind of like fun. Hanging out. And so that's the favorite. I think everyone in the band would agree that that's one of their favorite videos.
What about a favorite video by another artist?
I like Talking Heads videos a lot.
First thing I saw of theirs was Once in a Lifetime, I think. That was the first video I saw.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Once in a Lifetime. Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime. But I also love Bjork videos. I love Human Nature. That might be one of my favorite videos, Human Nature. And I love Sia's videos very much, too.
Do you have a recent musical discovery that you'd like to share with our listeners? It doesn't necessarily have to be a new band, but something that's new to you.
I just recently got turned on to KT Tunstall. You know, it caught my ear because I hear it on our local station here, WOMR, out in the Cape, Outermost Cape Radio. And I was like, oh, who's that? It happened to me several times. It's like, who is that? Oh, and it turned out to be her. So, yeah, I think that's kind of a little bit of a new discovery.
What band or artist do you love but feel that they perhaps never quite got the big break they deserved?
Mm-hmm. I love the Feelies. And Monica and I always try to go see them whenever they've been in Woodstock a few times. But I'd love to dance to the Feelies. And also the Ramones, I feel like they never got sort of the due. I think now they're very revered, but they still didn't get big commercial success. And I think Patti Smith is famous enough, but she didn't have like a, maybe as much as she should. But people, everyone loves Patti Smith. I mean, everyone's like, oh, Patti Smith. And she is one of my very favorite artists of all time.
She did an episode of this podcast a year or so ago, and it was so much fun. I've met her and interviewed her before, but she is like the coolest lady.
Yeah, I've met her times, and she's actually kind of shy.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's a shaman when she's on stage. It's just amazing.
Do you have a musical guilty pleasure?
Neil Diamond.
Oh, I love Neil Diamond.
Yeah.
Whenever I hear one of his songs, I'm like, this guy wrote the best shit.
I know.
His songs are amazing.
And of course, this isn't a guilty pleasure. I love Jimmy Webb, and I love, you know, MacArthur Park is one of the songs I really like. But I would say Neil Diamond is a guilty pleasure. Yeah.
And we got one question left, which we always finish up with it. And that is, how are you feeling right now?
I said to my wife, Monica, I feel like the best in my life right now. In a lot of ways, because I have got this place on the Cape, and we're swimming in the ocean, and we're like, holy mackerel, we have this place. We can go and swim in the ocean, and we have a house in Woodstock in the mountains, and I feel energized. I'm going to do some solo shows. I have a record coming out. The B-52s are doing this Vegas residency. We're going to do another one in November. So I just feel like things are sort of really good right now.
Well, I'm so happy to catch up. Great talking with you, Kate. Thank you so much.
Nice seeing you again, Nick.
The Sound of Success is hosted and produced by me, Nick Harcourt, for Nude and Ginger Productions. Our theme music is by Keita Klein. For more episodes, find us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, and thanks for listening.